Die Presse.
Thomas, du bist wieder mal in Wien.
Ja, ich bin in Wien. Hallo.
Hallo. Du warst ja viel unterwegs in letzter Zeit.
Ja, ich war in München.
Aber zunächst einmal ein Hallo und herzlich willkommen auch an unsere Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer. Willkommen zu einer neuen Folge der Eastside Stories. Wir sind Martina Czarnowska
und Thomas Seifert.
Also, jetzt erzähl mal von München.
Was willst du wissen? Weißbier? Nein, ich war zweimal in München, und zwar das eine Mal bei der DLD-Konferenz. DLD heißt Digital Life Design, und das ist eine Konferenz für Innovation und Technologie, digitalen Medien und Gesellschaft. Und die wird veranstaltet von Hubert Burda Media, also einer großen deutschen, ja, früher hätte man gesagt Verlag, mittlerweile ist es wirklich ein Multimedia-Unternehmen. Und dort ging es in mehreren Panels um den sogenannten European Tech Stack. Also die Frage, wie kann Europa sich im Bereich der digitalen Medien, der digitalen Technologien unabhängiger von den USA machen? Und da war ich unter anderem eingeladen zu einem kleinen Gespräch in kleinerer Runde mit der früheren Wettbewerbskommissarin Margrethe Vestager, und die hat ihre Initiative Rebuild vorgestellt, die europäische Social-Media-Plattformen besser fördern will, sichtbarer machen will und da auch wirklich in Konkurrenz treten will zu den großen amerikanischen Giganten wie zum Beispiel Facebook, Instagram oder eben YouTube, Google etc. Und es gibt bereits über 120 solcher Plattformen überall in Europa. Und die Vestager hat eben dort in München vor dieser digitalen Abhängigkeit sehr stark gewarnt und hat zum Beispiel Zahlen auf den Tisch gelegt, die, glaube ich, ja, vor allem natürlich Medienmenschen, wie wir beides auch sind, wirklich große Sorgen machen, weil allein Meta, also denen gehört Facebook und Instagram, und die ziehen jährlich 50 Milliarden Euro aus Europa ab, also an Werbung. Und unsere Nachrichten, unsere Communities, unsere Demokratie, all das, so sagt sie, hängt sehr stark von US-amerikanischen oder auch chinesischen Plattformen. Ja, Klammer auf, damit meint sie vor allem TikTok, Klammer zu, was China betrifft. Und dann war ich nochmal in München und dann, das war eben erst vor ein paar Wochen, auf der Münchner Sicherheitskonferenz.
Und um genau diese Themen, die du jetzt angesprochen hast, um Europas digitale Souveränität, um den Umgang mit den Tech-Giganten, aber auch um die großen geopolitischen Herausforderungen, geht es in unserem heutigen Gespräch mit der ehemaligen EU-Kommissarin Vera Jourova.
Genau. Ja, aber bevor wir zu dem Gespräch kommen, hören wir zuerst in eine Stadt hinein, in der gerade sehr viel in Bewegung ist.
Wir haben nämlich eine Sprachnachricht aus Belgrad bekommen, von Brankica Janković. Sie war bis zum Feuer die Kommissarin für den Schutz der Gleichstellung der Republik Serbien und engagiert sich seit langem für Frauenrechte, sozialen Dialog und den Dialog zwischen den Generationen. Also Antidiskriminierung in einem weiten Kontext, unter anderem im Rahmen eines UNESCO-Netzwerks. Und noch immer unter dem Eindruck der schon erwähnten Münchner Sicherheitskonferenz und kurz vor einem Wirtschaftsforum schickte Brankica uns folgende Nachricht.
Voice Message. What's up, Belgrad? Dobar dan, this is Brankica Janković from Belgrade. As I walk through the streets, I find myself reflecting on Munich Security Conference as a place of open and honest discussion about the herd of elephants in the room, the future of the rule based of the international order and the erosion of fundamental values titled Under Destruction. At the same time, I'm thinking about how urgently we in Belgrade need the broadest possible dialogue on security issues of the current complex political dynamics. It is important that young people in Serbia are demanding justice in our streets every day. We have daily youth protests calling for accountability and justice, and that is our hope and our strength. I believe that we will soon be able to talk about all difficult issues, because until we restore accountability, democracy, dialogue, and normal institutional functioning, unfortunately, everything else, including very rich cultural and social life of our city, will remain in the shadows. Still, I'm preparing for the Koponik Business Forum, largest in Serbia in the end of this week, where I will run an important panel on the silver economy and the challenges of demographic aging in Serbia and the region. We'll also discuss the importance of intergenerational dialogue and finding a new ways of generational investment across Europe, because Gen Z and the baby boomers together can create a new values. I believe that dialogue between generations is key to transforming demographic challenges into a development opportunity.
Das war Brankica Janković. Ja, die Jugendproteste in Serbien reißen nicht ab. Die Menschen fordern Rechenschaftspflicht und Gerechtigkeit ein. Brankica spricht aber auch von der Hoffnung auf einen sozialen Dialog und darauf, dass demokratische Institutionen wieder funktionieren können. Apropos Dialog und Demokratie, als Plattform dafür ist uns ja am Anfang das Internet verkauft worden.
Ja, genau so ist es. Habe ich auch lange geglaubt.
Schöne neue Digitalwelt.
Ja.
Doch in welche Richtung sie sich gedreht hat, haben wir kurz angesprochen. Und wir wollen auch wissen, ob die Europäer dem noch etwas entgegensetzen können.
Und damit kommen wir zu unserem Hauptgespräch. Vera Jourová war 10 Jahre lang EU-Kommissarin, zunächst zuständig für Justiz, Verbraucherschutz und Gleichstellung, dann als Vizepräsidentin für Werte und Transparenz. Sie ist derzeit als erste Karl-Schwarzenberg-Fellow am Institut für die Wissenschaften von Menschen in Wien im 9. Bezirk. Wir haben mit ihr über Europas digitale Souveränität, den Kampf gegen Desinformation, den Umgang mit Trump, Putin und den Tech-Giganten gesprochen. Und über die Frage, ob Europa aus seinen Krisen wieder stärker hervorgehen kann.
Das hören wir uns jetzt an.
You are the first Karl Schwarzenberg Fellow, who is actually, by the way, a member of the Board of European Voices that I also represent. And he embodied the dissenting opinion, the dissenting tradition of Havel's Prague. Yeah? And then you went to Brussels, you built your career there. And you were kind of the master regulator. This is what you're known for, that a lot of the regulatory regime that we see, especially in the digital space, was under your guidance. And so how do you bring these two things together? Like on the one hand, let's say this political dissent and kind of being a bit not want to be regulated in the broader sense, let's say, being this wild political animal that Havel was, with this regulatory seal.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for your interest. Thank you for inviting me. And thank you, Vienna, for hosting me. And Karl Schwarzenberg, of course, I've been honored to be the first person who received this fellowship. And I try to use the time here as much as possible and to do good things. It's an interesting question because I came to the Commission being really injected by the spirit and ideas of Václav Havel and Karl Schwarzenberg, who I think both might agree with the slogan, live and let live. Yeah, this is the liberal kind of idea. And I came to the Commission in the middle of the negotiations of GDPR, of the privacy rules. And I can tell you, it was not only GDPR, but several other things where I had a very strange feeling, hey, aren't we overregulating? Shouldn't we do things easier, drop many things which might annoy people, which are not necessary? Should we try to improve the world or Europe by the means of heavy regulation? So you may not believe me, but I have a long list of the things which I prevented to happen. At the same time, of course, I am signed under GDPR, which I tried to soften a little bit at the end. But I believe that we needed rules to protect privacy of people. And I am signed under some big pieces of regulation relating to digital world, Digital Services Act, which is now the pain in the stomach of Americans and Washington leaders. We can talk about it maybe later. But I am signed under the AI Act, but also under the regulation on the free media and the regulation of the European Public Prosecutor's Office. So a broad range of things, which I would say, yes, indeed, it's regulation, but it was necessary. It's done, it's written in the proportionate manner. On the other hand, sometimes I am about to shout when I hear or read how the EU regulations are applied in practice. Because, for instance, GDPR was totally misunderstood in my country, in Czechia. Whenever I signed useless papers, whether I agree with something under the GDPR, I want to shout, this is not necessary. But that's life.
But let's talk about the bigger picture also, because, of course, people will probably always annoy you with this sentence where they say, well, you know, America innovates, China replicates, Europe regulates. And then usually they burst out laughing, and if it's in Davos or in one of these places. So what answer do we have for that?
Well, yes, I always reply that not all innovations are good and not all regulations are bad. some regulation was necessary. An example, Digital Services Act, which as I said, is difficult to swallow for the American digital industry. Well, we have laws in all member states which prohibit hate speech. It's very well defined in the national laws, which were designed many decades ago for a very good reason, still under the impression of the Second World War and Holocaust. The Americans do not have concentration camps on their territory. So by importing their business on Europe onto European territory, with the conviction that we will take it all with everything, it's a mistake. We have to defend our space and defend also our security. And so here I think that the regulation was necessary. The same with the regulation of the which should increase the protection of children, the protection against terrorism and extremism. I think that we had a million reasons to regulate the digital space.
And also on one question, I mean, you are from Czechia, so you grew up in the Czechoslovakia under communist rule. And also I sometimes think it's interesting if you see people, let's say, from especially in this age group who were still have an experience of how it was like, or in East Germany or in Czechoslovakia or grew up in Hungary, communist Hungary. And you always see that they have a more, let's say, they're a bit more critical when it comes to, okay, what is this, what can the state do? Because they knew what the state did then, but also what it means to be surveyed. I mean, of course, in Albania, it was horrible, but everywhere people were surveyed and people have this strange feeling, okay, you have to be a bit careful. And it feels to me that in West, maybe we always had this feeling, yeah, everything is fine and hanky-dory. And maybe we don't see that we also surveyed. We self-survey. I mean, whenever I post on Instagram, which I do probably every day almost, then it means I've given out information to Meta, to this. It's not the Stasi like it was in the GDR, but it's a company, right? So what do you think about that? Do you think that the Eastern Europeans, at least this generation who grew up with this experience, that they are more careful what they do digitally, what they do in their life, to be a bit more concerned about the state might be not your friend one day? And of course, companies, usually the profit is their friend, not you.
It's interesting question because it makes me to remember my times in the commission. I was there 10 years and I happened to be very close to come with the solutions on many, many different things. And in my job, I very often felt that I am using the experience of somebody who lived 25 years in communist regime. Just take GDPR. And the protection of privacy, I think that this is an important thing to have own identity protected and to know what's happening to you and who is doing something to you. In communism, we didn't have a clue. We were totally helpless. And I had a feeling that when you give your data to the digital space, you appear in the same situation. You don't know what's happening to your identity. Who is selling you? Who is spying you? And so this was this instinct which told me, yes, protection of privacy is needed. Although in Czechia, I was heavily criticized and the privacy was not meant to be or understood as the main thing compared with Austrians or Germans who wanted to have much stronger protection of privacy. So in Czechia, I still heard something like, if we don't do anything wrong, we shouldn't mind that somebody is spying on us. Strange. It is the heritage of the communist time, definitely.
Yeah, Franz Kafka would have seen it differently because I think there's this famous sentence, I don't know how it exactly goes, but he says, yes, but I didn't do anything. And then the voice says, I think, yes, you're talking like a person who's guilty, right?
Exactly.
This is Franz Kafka, no?
Yeah. I watched the film about him and I think the sentence was there and I realized, yes, this is all about the feeling of each individual facing the power.
Yeah.
Unlimited power.
So as soon as you talk, there's nothing to fear,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And this confrontation with unlimited power, which I still feel from my young years, suddenly I saw it again and I realized that you can fall victim of some kind of tyranny or dictatorship, not only because of ideology, that it can happen to you because of somebody's big business. So I was born under a lucky star because I was close to these things, a fascinating journey. I remember when I was at the Liberals Congress, I said something like, look, guys, it was 2016. We cannot fight against everybody. We cannot at the same time fight against Putin and Zuckerberg. The people didn't understand. And now we are fighting, in fact, in Europe against Putin and Zuckerberg.
And Trump, you could say, well, or J.D. Vance.
Yeah. Of course, against this concentration of power, yeah? And or another instinct from the Eastern person was the migration wave. There were a lot of ideas how to solve the situation. And I was really very critical when I heard the solution through the migration quota, that we will take the migrants, be it legal or illegal, it doesn't matter, and we will just transport them to the countries of the EU. Mm. And I was so upset. I said, this cannot work. The people don't want to go to these countries, and these countries don't want to accept them. And it was, you can imagine, in 2015, it was something very dangerous to say. The political correctness, at least, was telling me, shut up, don't say it. You will be punished for that. But I didn't want to give up. And I said, shouldn't we have zones for the migrants? Shouldn't we prepare a zone for Ukrainians in the center and eastern Europe? I felt after the annexation of Crimea in 2014 that something bigger will come. So these are the feelings which you asked about, whether these feelings and instincts helped me to take some positions on these difficult matters we speak about.
What I want to get at is, like, when we remember we had this kind of, oh, now Europe needs to wake up, the wake-up call. Remember that one? Zeitenwende, wake-up call, all this. And of course, you know it much better than me, coming from the region, that, yeah, the people in Poland, they were very much awake even before Crimea happened. In the Czech Republic, I mean, you started with the munitions initiative for Ukraine. We can go on and on. In Romania, they had a huge election interference. They were the first to took action. So people have woken up in the East. One has a feeling, but after, of course, the full-scale invasion, even more so. We're still, I think Berlin was putting the snooze button. Madrid is somewhere else, you know, they're far out west. France, yeah, maybe, but isn't that also that when we talk about Europe, I think you knew much earlier than what was happening than the rest, than Brussels, for instance, wasn't it?
I want to be fair. I agree with you that the east of Europe is awakened already fully, yeah, and of course the imminent threat is close to us, yeah. But I want to be fair in saying, I would never believe that we might be so stably united on the reaction of the Russian aggression on Ukraine. And whenever I went to Spain or Portugal in the debates with the students or general public or politicians, the topic of Ukraine was number one and still is. And so I would not say that the Western Europe does not feel or understand the threat and is not solidar enough. They are. But at the same time, well, we still are facing some, I would even say today, shameful underestimation of who Putin is and what imperial appetite Putin's Russia has. And I appeared on the Russian sanctions list in 2020. When I said publicly that the European Union is totally overflooded with or by the Russian produced disinformation. And the reaction was they put me on the sanctions list. It was meant to be other people to say this. For instance, I loved him, but Josep Borrell, who was the High Representative for Foreign Affairs, it was his task to be first. And instead, he was criticizing me for being Russophobe. Mm. Well, yes, with my experience. And nobody should be surprised. So there is, of course, always slightly different reaction on the things, again, stemming from the historical experience and geographical situation. But on Russian aggression, we remain united. I don't count Hungary.
And you already mentioned there is not only Putin, but there is also Mark Zuckerberg and others in the digital sphere, and also, as we found out, Donald Trump, and not only him, of course, J.D. Vance and the whole lot. And isn't there also we're making the same mistake that we for too long thought, yeah, we can manage him somehow, or the White House, we can manage the Americans somehow. Then we find out, maybe not. So did we make the same mistake to think for too long that, yeah, somehow we can muddle through with this guy? And then we find out, no, we cannot. Maybe we, and the moment, at least there was some signaling when it, after, you know, especially Greenland, that, okay, again, it seems like Europe somehow finally at least doesn't press the snooze button and is waking up. And again, it's others more than Merz, for instance. It's not that the Germans are the ones who are seem to be woken up to the challenge. Of course, the Danes have woken up because Greenland, right? But do you think we make the same mistake?
This is the moment when many of us, especially the politicians, are facing a totally new situation. To start to believe something which used to be incredible or unbelievable. The shock from Mr. Trump's positioning towards EU as the many decades lasting main partner is too big to swallow and to react quickly in the proper way. And I think you were asking about waking up. Yes, it's time to show the power. And I was not lamenting about the lack of courage of the EU or a lack of reaction. I liked the exercise in Davos when Mr. Trump came with his fantastic idea of his peace corps, where there is Belarusian dictator and so on. It's, for me, this is a bizarre thing. But EU representatives, Ursula von der Leyen, came to Davos with the message, if you impose tariffs on the countries which actively defend Denmark in the Greenland case, we will react by starting or triggering the anti-coercion instrument, which was designed
for the Chinese.
Yeah. And she, I was not there this year, but I can imagine that Ursula and her colleagues did it in the way that even Trump had to realize they mean it seriously. And they will do it. It would be very big blow to American investors, to the companies who run for the public in the public procurements in the EU for big money, for the copyright protection. Many things would drastically change for American business. Ursula showed, yes, we mean it. So this is what I mean by not having lack of courage. So to show that we are not helpless. The same thing where I was missing more courage was when Mr. Trump was imposing or threatening by tariffs on goods. Europe should have answered, but we can also impose a digital tax, which would mean some financial loss for your technological army. So I think that there are possibilities and Mr. Trump understands the power.
An dieser Stelle unterbrechen wir kurz. Wir wollen nämlich etwas Werbung für die kommende Ausgabe von European Voices machen, die Mitte März erscheint.
Ja, und in dieser Ausgabe beschäftigen wir uns mit den Möglichkeiten, wie Europa seine Stärken ausspielen kann.
Es hat nämlich so einige im gesellschaftlichen, kulturellen, rechtlichen Bereich, aber auch in der Wirtschaft. In der Pharmaindustrie, im modernen Maschinenbau, in der Luft- und Raumfahrt spielt Europa auf dem Weltmarkt eine dominante Rolle.
Genau, und das alles beleuchten wir. Und übrigens, weil wir ja im Gespräch mit Vero Jourova sehr viel auch über Tech sprechen, niemand weiß oder kaum Menschen wissen, dass man ohne bestimmte Maschinen, die in Holland produziert werden, überhaupt keine Chips auf dieser Welt produzieren könnte. Und in diesen Maschinen sind Spiegel von einer Firma in Deutschland, wo überhaupt niemand Chips produzieren könnte, praktisch auf der ganzen Welt.
Das und noch einiges andere in der nächsten Ausgabe von European Voices. Nun aber zurück zu unserem Gespräch mit Vera Jourova.
And then I think this is the right entry point for going into the digital realm, which is, as you said, you're working now at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna on this issue as well. That, okay, when dialogue is facilitated in rooms that are made to be like a boxing ring, like mm-hmm. social media, like digital, a lot of digital space is organized this way because it brings clicks. This is the business model of you know, rage or outrage is the business model of some of these platforms. So how can we go back to, let's say, this meaningful dialogue, to listen to each other, to not the most outrageous quote is the one that should get a lot of, let's say, airtime, but maybe, as you said, like this one voice who's there, who's doubting, even when it says, utters a word, it already doubts that, yes, there's maybe another solution as well, this kind of more open thinking that democracy, I think also, I'm truly agreeing that we need. So how do we deal with a public space that is not like it used to be the parliament or
agora.
The agora in Greece, yes, in Athens, but it's like a shouting match. It's like the most crazy person gets the most clicks.
Yeah, I admit for a while the nickname you gave me that I am the regulation master.
Sorry about that. I apologize.
No, I take it with humor, but honestly, we worked on the digital regulation also with the aim of destroying this privatization of public space. Yeah? And the algorithms which are dividing people, families, society. And we did our part of the work. It's there in the regulation. There is a possibility for the European Commission to look into the algorithms. And when they find out that the algorithm works in the direction of dividing people, which they are, yeah, we know it, then the Commission can take some steps, even the sanction possible. But what I am still missing is the reaction of the society. Without that, we will not be able to improve the situation, to restore our ability to speak to each other. So I am waiting for the reaction of the society. I was now 1 year at the Charles University, and I noticed that whenever we organized some events where people could meet people, we had much higher numbers of the people who wanted to come. So I think I cannot judge from such a small sample. But I think that the reaction of the society will be that the people will get, sorry to say it like that, but pissed off by being in the space of full of dirt and violence, of the space where they cannot have a normal, decent discussion with other people. I think that there must be some reaction of the society which will bring people more outside this digital space. And maybe even, and I know about such attempts, to create something new in digital space where there will be rules for decent communication. I would even say the AI should not be invited. The people should discuss under their names, and where the freedom of speech would be fully protected. Because my theory is that now in the jungle, where we have to behave live, and it's not my case, I am not on social media almost at all, but we know how big percentage of the population lives online, there is a big outcry that we should protect the freedom of speech of everybody who is using this space. But are we sure? These are real people. The freedom of speech has been invented as a constitutionally guaranteed right for real people, not for somebody under the nickname who may not be even the real person, who might be just a bot. You know what I mean?
With a political agenda, maybe financed by Russia or whoever political actor there is, yeah.
Just, I would say, show me your name and face, and I will guarantee you absolute freedom of speech. Because you should also have some responsibility for your words. You know, the right has to go with responsibility. But it's maybe utopia still that there will be a new system which will work like that.
I'm wondering whether we already maybe see some young green sprouts of that. Because, for instance, in Austria, we have now a debate. it's not like super loud, but it's beginning, about banning social media use for kids under certain ages. Some talk about 14, some talk about 16, what we had in Britain, also Australia and so on. May I ask you, what do you think of that? Are you think that's a good idea, at least to start with young people, to say, listen, you should not, this room is for adults only, so to speak. What do you think about that?
Definitely, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
And I congratulated through BBC also to Australia that they had the courage to do that. When I look back at my commission work, I think that we should have done three more things. To look into this freedom of speech protection relating to real people, to try to differentiate, and not to protect the freedom of speech of the bots. I spoke about that. The second thing, to look at the platforms more from the perspective of the media rather than advertising industry, because the media are dying in the EU, not only under the pressure of politicians, but also and mainly under the pressure from the side of digital platforms. And the media rightly complain, we have such a heavy regulation. We must not just easily distribute sex, violence, and dirty money. And the platforms are doing that. So it was the second neglected thing. The third and the most important, I think, was the not strong enough protection of children, the strict parental control, strict pressure on the digital systems to guarantee the right or the proper content going to the children, and vice versa, the dangerous content not to go there. And I think that now we will see individual efforts of individual member states, be it Austria, be it Spain, be it Denmark. We already hear voices of influential politicians who say, yes, the Australian inspiration made us work on it. We are not going to wait for the EU to move. So probably we will see a fragmentation of the laws, which, by the way, the American digital industry does not like.
Yeah, it makes it more complicated for them.
Indeed, indeed. So I would predict that maybe the big digital systems will come with some proposal of some code of conduct to increase the protection of children. But it's just my personal prediction. And they will not do it. If they will do it, they will not do it because of the interests of the children, but again, because of their business interests, to be sure that the rules are everywhere the same in Europe.
But also you mentioned that the Americans are not happy with this sort of regulation that we had and have in the European Union. At the same time, the Americans tried to and actually successfully forced ByteDance, a Chinese company, to sell the American operation of TikTok to American group of owners.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, interestingly enough, friends of Trump among them, I should also add.
Surprise.
Surprise, yes. But also then, I mean, why are not we doing that? I mean, if the Americans are doing it with the Chinese, why aren't we in Europe saying, listen, guys, I mean, you can run Instagram and Facebook and whatever you like, but yes, it has to be under European ownership. It has to be, you have to sell it. You can use the same name, whatever it is, but it has to be under European, basically sail under European flag, just like in the airline industry. Like if you have an airline operating in Europe, flying out from European airports, it has to be European airline. It cannot, for instance, Austrian Airlines cannot be owned by a non-EU member, owner from a non-EU member state. It's actually Austrian Airlines is owned by Lufthansa, but basically it's all in the European Union. And do you think that that is a solution? Is that feasible? Is that actually a good idea or a bad idea?
You ask why don't we? So, of course, we have to ask who is we? Maybe it would be for some European businesses to join forces and to buy it. But it cannot be the purchase pushed top down from the political side. I cannot imagine the commission, for instance, to collect money to buy TikTok.
I want to end on our discussion and conversation on a positive note. And I want to invite you to go kind of revisiting the spirit of 89 and thinking about, okay, what if we manage to kind of go back and find, okay, after some soul searching, after some looking at the kind of in the mirror and say, okay, we are in a new world. I think it's clear for us now that, okay, actually Europe, I mean, the Americans, we had like, you know, since, let's say, the Vienna Congress of Vienna, Wiener Congress, how many wars did we have? And still look where we are now. I mean, then first of all, you know, that the French and the Germans are not fighting each other anymore. Fortunately, the European Union came. The Balkan Wars, it's at one point, everybody is now in the region dreaming of joining the European Union together. So what I'm trying to say maybe is, okay, we have gone through so many difficult phases and we have managed. And of course, this is we quote Monet, you know, we quote the spirit of, yes, we will somehow from crisis get out stronger. And now I'm asking you with a hopeful, let's say, tone is my voice. Do you think we can put it off again?
I feared you will ask me where we made mistakes.
No.
I think that it was Nietzsche who said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I think that now we have a strong reason to get stronger. And it is connected with your idea of having a statue of Mr. Trump in Brussels. I will contribute financially to this, maybe even to build their statue of Mr. Orban.
If they have a long nose, I think so too.
because
Pinocchio is.
I would not ridicule him, but just Mr. Trump now is one of the strong reasons to really think about what to drop, what is making us weaker and what will make us stronger and do it together. And I know it looks like or sounds like a phrase, but it should be projected into a reasonable series of actions which the EU will propose and do. Many things can be done quickly. It's not true that the European Union must be slow. Look at what we did in COVID. Look, how quickly we had the sanctions against Russia. So when it's necessary, we can be quick. But we need to have a support of all or almost all. So again, to drop the things which are weakening us and join forces to do things properly and maybe redefine common interests. Somebody very wise, my colleague Ivan Krastev, who I can spend time with now in Vienna, he said the other day that European Union can have common dream, but each nation of the EU has its own national nightmares. And I think this is very, very well described. So let's work on the common dream.
Das war unser Gespräch mit Vera Jourova. Zwei Dinge bleiben besonders hängen. Erstens, Europa ist nicht hilflos. Es hat Instrumente, um sich gegen die Machtkonzentration der Tech-Giganten zu wehren, aber auch gegen Donald Trump und Wladimir Putin, sei es mit Handelsbeschränkungen oder einer Digitalsteuer. Und zweitens, der digitale öffentliche Raum muss zurückerobert werden. Redefreiheit sollte für echte Menschen gelten, nicht für Bots mit politischer Agenda. Außerdem brauchen Kinder deutlich stärkeren Schutz im Netz. Den Link zum Gespräch mit Vera Jourova finden Sie jedenfalls in den Shownotes.
Ebenso Informationen zur aktuellen Ausgabe der European Voices.
Das war Kapitel 12 der East Side Stories.
Schön, dass Sie dabei waren.
Hören Sie uns wieder.
Servus.
Do usłyszenia.